Okay, our second case this morning is 17-2102, United States versus Hargrove. Mr. Ray?
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Ray, and I represent the defendant and appellant, John Wayne Hargrove. I respectfully request to reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal. Mr. Hargrove is here today asking the court to reverse both his conviction and his sentence on two distinct grounds, but both of which involve guns, even though there were no firearm charges at issue in this case. Now, the first ground goes to the need to respect the district court's pretrial order, holding that the fact that a pistol found in Mr. Hargrove's vehicle was stolen was not to be mentioned. The government went on to elicit testimony from an agent that only could have called for this fact, despite the fact it was highly prejudicial, and it really had no bearing on an issue presented, just as the court had found pre-trial. Given the questions that were answered and the circumstances of this case, the district court should have granted a mistrial, and we're asking this court to remand for a new trial. Now, secondly,
What was the prejudice? What would you point to as the prejudicial aspect?
The prejudice is to transform the situation where Mr. Hargrove was lawfully possessing a firearm in a rural area, in which many people would do so, and to paint him then as a criminal, that when he otherwise had no criminal history, and to paint him as having committed another crime he wasn't charged with and couldn't practically defend against.
Well, wait a minute. What did the defense witness, the passenger in the pickup, what was her testimony about the guns?
I believe she testified about Mr. Hargrove's intent as to the drugs. I don't believe she testified to his bringing the firearms for the purpose of the drug transaction, which is a key distinction. And she certainly didn't testify.
Can't we infer from the fact that there's a large quantity of drugs in the pickup, closely connected in space with the firearms, that they were part of the drug transaction? Our cases stand for the proposition that guns are tools of the trade. They were his guns. They were at the scene of the crime, so to speak.
As to the
I'm just wondering why the testimony at trial would be particularly prejudicial given that back pattern.
Your Honor, I would submit that it goes to the fact of them having been stolen. And when you look at Mr. Hargrove's defense, that he really didn't understand what was going on and this wasn't his idea, he was in a rural place for working, for fishing activities in which you would potentially have firearms, when you inject the potential of it being stolen, we would submit that that could only be used to infer some type of criminal propensity by him.
All right. Well, that gets to it. You suggest that the prejudice is propensity. Essentially, it painted him as a bad guy. Well, the district court gave an instruction which said you cannot infer anything based upon the testimony you heard. Nothing. So why in the world does that not encompass you cannot infer that he is a bad guy? And if you believe that the jury is going to follow the instructions, which our law indicates that they would, why isn't it done?
Your Honor, I would cite to the Hardwell case and say, well, if you look at this instruction in its entirety, we would submit that the takeaway was you can't use that to infer guilt of the charged offense.
That's not what it said. You said you cannot infer anything from this. And generally, doesn't propensity evidence, isn't the evil of propensity evidence mean that the jury is more likely to think the defendant did it?
Did it, Your Honor, because he's a bad person.
That's right. Well, if they say you cannot infer anything related to this crime based upon the testimony about the stolen gun, why doesn't that neutralize that?
Your Honor, when this type of evil is at issue, that he's a bad person, we would submit Hardwell stands for the proposition that the jury should have been told that they could not use this evidence to infer that Mr. Hargrove was a bad person, more predisposed to commit a crime, which was particularly relevant here in light of the nature of his defense.
Well, but considering what you just argued, he's already acknowledged that the guns in the cab of that pickup were his. So stolen or not, he's saying that, going back to the issue of prejudice, he's already told the jury that, yeah, those are my guns.
Your Honor, a gun can be owned, it can be lawfully possessed, but if it's stolen...
I recognize that. I'm saying, giving you the benefit of your argument and going back to the question of prejudice, that he was so prejudiced that the outcome of this the jury's verdict more likely than not would have been different. But you've got to overcome also the question of prejudice in light of what the court instructed the jury in regards to this matter. And I'm saying, okay, he's already admitted that the rifle and I believe the pistol was his. And that's the pistol, I think, that was referred to as what's being stolen. I don't see where there's prejudice then if the jury, which our law says, are required and we assume that they followed the instruction that was given to them.
We would submit, Your Honor, that there are different types of evidence that are more qualitatively prejudicial than others. Certainly that embraced by 404B. And saying it's stolen infers, suggests that he's committed some other type of crime. Maybe that he was the one that stole the firearm. Maybe that he was involved in some other type of firearm offense.
Now, we're with you on that. The question is whether the trial judge took adequate steps to mitigate the potential prejudice that flowed from that statement, and why, you know, there was a curative instruction. As I understand the record, the ownership issue did not come up again. The prosecution did not put on additional gun evidence. Why weren't those steps adequate to? I know you can't unring the bell, but why weren't those steps adequate to mitigate the potential harm to your client?
We would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that in light of Hardwell and the totality of the instruction given here, it did not go far enough to make clear that the jury could not conclude he was a bad person. That should have been given in light of Hardwell. It was not given.
But the problem with Hardwell, that instruction really was mangled. It was a very confusing instruction. Here, as I think Judge Holmes was suggesting, there's no confusion. You know, any means any. And doesn't that really distinguish this case from Hardwell?
I would submit no, Your Honor, because of the nature of Mr. Hargrove's defense, the circumstances of this case, and the fact that we were referring to another potential crime that he could have committed, the jury could have so inferred, we would submit that the instruction should have gone farther. Not that it needed to be three times longer, it could have been a few more words.
Mm-hmm. Is the question here, though, an abuse of discretion standard?
It is, Your Honor.
Okay, the question is whether the court abused its discretion by not giving the instruction you wanted. I mean, that the cases that you're relying on are, they don't mandate, Hardwell didn't mandate that instruction, did it?
Hardwell, under these type of circumstances, we would submit that Hardwell stands for the proposition that the jury should have been told it could not use it to conclude criminal propensity. That's our position, Your Honor. And we submit that the district court's application of the factors was not a reasonable choice under the circumstances and that a mistrial should have been granted. We're also asking, in addition, that the court reverse Mr. Hargrove's sentence on the basis of denial of the so-called safety valve, which is set forth in 5C1.2 and Section 3553F. And the only question is, did he, in the words of the guideline, possess a firearm in connection with the offense? And we would respectfully submit that the district court erred when it said the mere proximity and potential for these firearms to be involved is enough. We would submit that is inconsistent with the Zavalza-Rodriguez case that says you have to look at the defendant's own conduct. There was no analysis here of the defendant's own conduct by the district court because of what we submitted, its erroneous legal conclusion that mere proximity and potential is enough.
You make an interesting argument regarding Zavalza. I'll give you that. But you look at footnote 2 of Zavalza, and that answers the question. Zavalza, it seems to me, in footnote 2, is focused on the question of distinguishing between conduct of the individual, actual possession or conduct of the individual, and attributed liability through conspirators or things of that sort, or constructive possession. That's the line that it was drawing. That was the line that it was drawing in Hallow. So here you've got a defendant who says, that's my gun. So you don't have the issue. In fact, in that footnote 2, Zavalza distinguished Hallam, and for the same reasons Zavalza distinguished Hallam, this case is distinguishable from Zavalza. Explain to me why that's not right.
Your Honor, in the Zavalza case, the gun was in the bedroom where Mr. Zavalza was found.
And he said it wasn't his gun, right? And that's not our case.
Ownership, though, we would submit, is not enough. You look at the language. You've got to have the guideline doesn't talk about ownership. The guideline talks about possession, and it talks about connection with the offense.
I have not heard you respond to my question about footnote 2 of Zavalza and the question that this is a different case than Hallam. And Zavalza made it clear this is a different case than Hallam, and it did it because in Hallam, in Zavalza, the defendant did not claim to own the gun or that no, the gun was even there, did he?
I believe that was his position.
That's right. Well, that's not this case. The defendant says, that's my gun. So the point, the line, the distinction you're drawing between it's the defendant's own conduct, well, we give you that. It's the defendant's own conduct. And the defendant says, that's my gun. So what else is there to talk about?
There's the question from the guideline, Your Honor. Did he possess it in connection with this offense?
That's right. And he says, it's my gun. It's in my car. The drugs are coming. Give that to me. Why is that not possessing in connection with the offense?
Well, Your Honor, what you didn't have from Mr. Hargrove here was the admission of a connection between guns and drugs.
Well, you had it from other testimony, did you not?
Mm-hmm.
It could be inferred from that.
No. It can't be. As I read the record in regards to this, his girlfriend testified when he was asked who did the planning, which evidently caught everybody by surprise. She said he did. Now, that's testimony as to his involvement in regards
to this. But what that testimony does not have, Your Honor, is a connection between the firearms and the offense.
Oh, why would it? I mean, if you do away with your defendant's own conduct thing, because the fact of the matter is the defendant's own conduct was to claim ownership of that gun, which is not what you had in Zavalza. So you got the defendant's conduct claiming ownership of the gun, you got the gun in the car, you got testimony not only from the girlfriend, but didn't you have testimony from the guy who was one of the mules who was in the car at the time?
Didn't I don't he think cooperate? He said anything about guns.
Well, that's not the point. He said something about dope, about the drugs. And so he said, the drugs are coming. There's the gun. I own the gun. What's
missing from both the other gentleman in the vehicle and from the girlfriend is an evidentiary basis of connection between the firearms and the drugs.
What I gather from your argument is that what you're wanting is a plus factor. What you want is there needed to be evidence that he had a prior record of distributing drugs. There needed to be evidence, I think there was something else that you said in his brief that was a possible plus factor, that he had a plan to use the weapon. Where is that the law? I don't get that.
It comes, Your Honor, from this court's case law to look at all of the circumstances and is there evidence of connection. And all of those things could be an evidentiary basis for a connection, which is the guidelines language. And here, Your Honor, we would submit there was no evidence of connection. I'd like to...
You wanted to reserve. I'll give you your 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Segovia?
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dustin Segovia, and I'm an assistant United States attorney from Las Cruces, New Mexico.
Now, let me ask you to start with, were you the trial counsel below that didn't follow the court's instruction?
I was trial counsel. I was not the AUSA who was engaging in that line of questioning, Your Honor.
Well, we try not to shoot the messenger, so...
That's much appreciated, Your Honor. There are two issues, and the district court did not commit error with respect to either issue. First, the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying Mr. Hargrove's motion for mistrial, which was based on a brief reference to one of the firearms in his truck having been stolen. Because that evidence was inconsequential in light of the mountain of evidence against Mr. Hargrove, it was elicited by mistake, and the court gave a proper limiting instruction that the jury could easily follow. With respect to the second issue, the district court did not commit clear error in denying safety valve relief to Mr. Hargrove because he was caught in the midst of a drug transaction in which there was approximately 300 pounds of marijuana in his truck, there were two firearms in his truck, and he had two knives on his person.
Let me ask you about this second round, and particularly since you were counsel as well, or one of the counsel at trial. Am I correct that the only safety valve issue that was being pursued, I think it's in fact the case that the only safety valve issue being pursued here is the firearm, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, help me to understand why he satisfies the fifth prong of the safety valve, which relates to providing truthful testimony given the fact that he testified and was found beyond a reasonable doubt. Help me.
This isn't in the record, Your Honor, but the United States safety valve, you aren't precluded from safety valve by simply going to trial.
I get that, but you're claiming that he provided truthful testimony to the government about his involvement in this offense?
Post-trial, a proffer statement, and this isn't in the record, but a proffer statement was provided to the government. The government did accept that statement with the exception of Mr. Hargrove's representations regarding the firearm.
Well, if it's not in the record, how do we know that?
Your Honor,
just because you say so?
Just trying to answer the question.
Well, but you told us it's not in the record, and I think we have to look at the record.
The record does establish that, if nothing else, the government conceded that argument by not raising it. So
no, you waived it. I'm not disputing that. I'm just puzzled by the fact that you waived it, given the circumstances that exist here. That's fine.
Understood, Your Honor, but even still, I think we still prevail on the safety valve issue. But
what other than proximity do we have connecting the guns to the drug transaction?
Well, Your Honor, let me start by saying that I disagree with the contention that mere proximity and potential to facilitate the offense is not enough. This court held as much as in Hallam, and in Zavala, the court did not overrule that proposition. Hallam remains good law, and in Payton, a published decision, this court said, it used a great word, it said the mere propinquity between the firearms and the drugs suggests a connection between the two.
Well, that's a quote that needs to be understood in context, and I think that the opposition would say that how the Zavalza provides the context and that it cabins that quote and makes it clear what's going on. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, you can't take language out of context. So the point is, what defendant's conduct, which was the word that Zavalza was focused on, what defendant's conduct was at play here?
Well, Your Honor, you have the fact, you have the troubling circumstances for Mr. Hargrove in which he's found. At the time that the Border Patrol agents arrived at his truck, he's in the passenger seat attempting to conceal himself and pretending to be asleep. On the dashboard, which he could reach, is a stolen, loaded 25 caliber pistol. His ex-girlfriend of 7 years is in the driver's seat. She's his co-conspirator. She implicates him at trial. In the back seat, there's another 22.
Yeah, she did not implicate him before trial, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's right. That's a convenient problem.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, looking at the circumstances, to get to the court's question, looking at the circumstances in which he's found, there's also the 22 caliber rifle. He could reach back and touch an approximately 50-pound bundle of marijuana, and one of the individuals who had just brought it to him in his truck is right behind him. It's difficult to conceive of a more close proximity between the drug offense and a jury found him guilty of possessing those narcotics with the intent to distribute it.
So did the fellow behind him testify? Remind me.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I apologize. Did the fellow behind him testify?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
Yes, okay.
And his testimony was significant because it established that Mr. Hargrove's it implicated Mr. Hargrove's knowledge of the drug conspiracy from the outset. Ms. Richter testified that they were going to take the drugs to Phoenix. They expected to be paid $5,000 when they got there. Mr. Silva, he knows the individual behind him, corroborated that testimony when he said that it was Mr. Hargrove who agreed to give him a ride to Phoenix. The government also listed testimony establishing that Phoenix was not on the way for Mr. Hargrove between Rodeo, New Mexico, and Pierce, Arizona. It was 200 miles east, so he would have had to go quite a bit out of his way to do that. The evidence at trial established that Mr. Hargrove was in on the jig from the beginning. And when he's caught, you have him within arm's reach of firearms and within arm's reach of marijuana. The marijuana that's in the bed of his truck, the testimony at trial established was that he was the person who placed it, he concealed it, he put the tarp over it, he strapped it down.
Are we reviewing the district court's determination for clear error?
Yes, Your Honor. In the safety valves context, that is the question. I want to go back to the point that proximity and potential to facilitate the offense is enough. The court's point about Payton is well taken. But since Zavalta and Payton have come down, this court, albeit in unpublished decisions, has four times said that proximity and potential to facilitate the offense is enough. It said so in the Castaneda-Asensio case in 2008, in the McClure case in 2009, in the Montgomery case in 2010, and in the Andrada Vargas in 2012.
And the albeit is a big point, isn't it? Albeit in unpublished cases, that's a big point, isn't it?
They're cited for their persuasive value, but if you have four different courts since Zavalza looking at...
Four different panels of our court.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yes.
Four different panels of this court have looked at arguments based on Zavalza, and Andrada Vargas in particular addressed it and said that mere proximity and potential to facilitate the offense is enough. Hallam has not been overturned on that point. Zavalza didn't do that, and this court, Your Honor, Judge Holmes, you made the point that Zavalza had to distinguish Hallam, which it did. Turning to the issue of the mistrial, the overarching question is whether Mr. Hargrove's right to a fair trial was violated. And in the context where the prosecutor induced the testimony, this court's looked at three factors: whether the government acted in bad faith, whether there was an adequate limiting instruction, and whether the evidence was the offending testimony was inconsequential in light of the other evidence. All of those factors weigh in favor of the government. And I want to start with bad faith. And at the outset, I'd like to note that while this court has reviewed denials of motion to mistrial for abuse of discretion, the government, I was doing last-minute research would suggest that the bad faith determination is, in fact, a factual finding that should be reviewed under the clear error standard. In different contexts, this court has applied the clear error standard to determining whether a district court clearly erred in making a bad faith determination. In the Bull case, this court said that it's a mixed question of law and fact, but that the question of intent was predominantly a factual question subject to clear error.
But that case, is that case cited in your brief or no?
It's not, Your Honor, and I'd be happy to submit a 28J letter to that effect. Under either standard, though, Your Honor, the government prevails because if we look at the bad faith issue, the defense argues that the government's references to ownership and its repeated questions suggest that there was bad faith. I'll say up front that the government made a mistake in eliciting the testimony that it did. But mistakes do not make for bad faith. And the district court made a determination that there wasn't bad faith, and defense counsel below didn't even argue it.
Part of the analysis of whether it was bad faith focuses on whether the line of testimony was objectively, the line of questioning was objectively reasonable. Is that right?
That's correct.
That's my understanding from the case law. And if that's true, what is unreasonable about inquiring about legal ownership? I mean, it's one thing to be talking about who possessed it, where it was, but legal ownership strikes me in this context as being a line of questioning that is directly going to lead you to the answer that you got. In fact, that's what the agent said. I had no choice if I wasn't going to lie but to say that. So what is reasonable about that line of questioning?
Your Honor, I think you have to look at the context of the trial, and you look at the context of the line of questioning. The questions regarding ownership, the goal, the purpose, the reason that it was asked, the reason that that was inquired into was to attempt to establish that Mr. Hargrove, and not Ms. Richter, was the individual who claimed ownership that night.
Ownership? Why is legal ownership relevant? We're talking whoever brought the gun, whose gun you possessed it. What? That's a distinct question, is it not?
That's
from who legally owned the gun?
That's correct, Your Honor. The question wasn't specifically about legal ownership.
It sure looked like it was directed in that direction. Do you disagree with that?
I don't disagree that a mistake was made when the question was asked. When the agent represented that he had done records checks.
What are you going to get out of a records check with legal ownership? Right?
If you look at the question, Your Honor, it was actually a compound question. And again, I'm seeing that a mistake was made, but I'm asserting that it wasn't done in bad faith. And if you look at the overall purpose, the purpose was to dispel from the jurors' minds that Ms. Richter could have been the owner of that firearm. The questions immediately leading up to that show that Ms. Richter was wearing a Raiders jacket, that the firearm was located in a Raiders bag, and the defense's theory was Ms. Richter was the mastermind.
How about who brought the gun?
I'm sorry,
Your Honor. How about who brought the gun?
That testimony,
I mean, why wouldn't that do it?
Your Honor, again, I concede that question should have been phrased differently.
The only thing I'm getting at here is you accept the notion that the objective reasonableness of the inquiry is part of the determination of whether there's bad faith, right?
That's correct, Your
okay.
Honor.
Okay.
On that point, I would just point out to the court that there was a proper purpose. As this court has recognized, firearms are tools of the trade. If the government could establish that those were Mr. Hargrove's firearms, they could argue that Mr. Hargrove brought his firearms because he knew he was going to participate in a drug transaction. The other consideration that this court has looked at, and Judge Timkovich probably knows this better than I from the Kamahiel decision, but this court has looked at whether the witness was instructed not to get into the offending testimony. Here, the court specifically asked the witness point blank, were you told not to go into that fact? And the witness said, yes, Your Honor, I was. He goes on to explain why he gave the answer he did, and I think it demonstrates the confusion that existed between the prosecutor asking the questions and the witness giving the answers, which is an unfortunate disconnect that happens more than I would like it to happen. But the point is that the district court is in the best position to take the witness's answer, to take the prosecutor's answers, and assess whether there's bad faith. And again, the defense counsel below didn't argue that this was done in bad faith.
On the question of prejudice and from the statement, what weight should we attribute to Ms. Richter's waffling testimony in making that evaluation? I've already inserted the word waffling, but it seems to me it fits, does it not?
Well, she was certainly impeached by prior inconsistent statements. But
I'm saying, when you're looking at the quantum of evidence that considers prejudice, what weight should we place on testimony that is different than the testimony that existed before? In other words, are you hanging your hat on Ms. Richter's testimony? I hope not.
Not at all, Your Honor, but I do think it was impactful. Let me start by the evidence that didn't rely on Ms. Richter. Before she ever took the stand, the government had established that Mr. Hargrove was discovered in a rural area in the middle of the desert. It's late at night. He's attempting to conceal himself. He's acting as though he's asleep. He's inside of his truck where there's 300 pounds of marijuana that he himself admits that he loaded, concealed. Well, I'm sorry, he didn't admit that, but the facts established that he was the person who loaded it. He was the person who concealed it. He was the person who strapped it down. Then there's his contention that he believed the marijuana was alfalfa, which jurors probably within the 10th Circuit know better, you know, than any other circuit, that marijuana and alfalfa do not smell alike or not taste alike.
Especially in Colorado.
That's absolutely right, Judge. That's the evidence before Ms. Richter even takes the stand. Ms. Richter had been painted by the defense as the individual who was going to come in and exonerate Mr. Hargrove. As part of his opening statement, the defense attorney told the jurors that Ms. Richter was going to take the stand and say, and I quote, "This was my deal, I did it." She was also going to say that it was easy for her to manipulate Mr. Hargrove. What happened was very, very different. Ms. Richter takes the stand, and instead of saying that she's the mastermind and that she lured Mr. Hargrove, she says that Mr. Hargrove is the individual who arranged the deal, that they were going to be paid $5,000 to go to Phoenix. And one of the backpackers corroborated that by saying that Mr. Hargrove agreed to give me a ride to Phoenix. The district court is in the best position to assess the impact of that testimony on the jury, which is why this court applies an abuse of discretion standard in this context. The court also was prudent in its course of action. It waited until after closing arguments to rule on the motion so that it could adequately assess the consequentiality of the offending testimony. The other point I want to make very quickly is that...
Yeah, you're over, so...
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor.
Wrap it up.
Stop there.
Okay. Very good, counsel. Now, I'll give you 2 minutes, Mr. Ray.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Your Honors, I would like to start by saying that the guidelines issue under the safety valve, this particular issue we submit is reviewed de novo, which is the meaning and scope of 5C1.2A2. And Zavalza Rodriguez says that. The meaning and scope of the guidelines provisions is a question of law that is reviewed de novo.
Yeah, that is. But what meaning is at play here? Yeah, this is a determination of whether he gets the safety valve or not, whether he qualifies. It's whether the facts support the safety valve. I mean, what meaning and scope is at play here? We're not on the edge here of anything.
Respectfully, Your Honor, it's whether mere proximity and potential is enough to preclude application of the safety valve.
You mean the question you've teed up via Zavalza?
Correct.
Okay, fine. So that's de novo. But once we've decided that question, then the court's underlying factual determination within the scope of that legal analysis or that legal rubric, that is reviewed for clear error, is it not?
Respectfully, Your Honor, we would contend that the district court never got to analyzing Mr. Hargrove's own conduct because it said in a written opinion before sentencing, mere proximity and potential is enough, and I'm not going to analyze anything more. And we, Your Honor, would rely on Zavalza Rodriguez to say that a closer degree of connection than mere proximity is necessary to preclude application of the safety valve.
And if the issue that was teed up in Zavalza is not at play here, then why would the court have to say anything about it? I mean, if the issue in Zavalza was, oh, well, he claims not to own the gun, it was constructive possession, those two issues are not at play here, why does the court have to say anything about that?
If I might answer the court's question,
please.
I have just a few seconds. But respectfully, if I could answer the court's question.
No, please respond.
Your Honor, the rule of law from Zavalza is that an analysis that the district court declined to engage in is required. The refusal to engage in that conduct-specific analysis to this defendant and this offense in determining eligibility under 5C1.2A2 was an error of law, and at a minimum, the case should be remanded to the district court to engage in that analysis.
Thank you, counsel. We understand your argument. Counsel are excused. The case will be submitted.